and phone messages. He spent the next 6 hours working his way through it, making calls and asking questions. As with Lourdes, he ended up with nothing to show for it, except a reinforcement of his belief that humans will sink to the lowest depths if the right opportunity presents itself. They were trying to catch a serial rapist who was evolving, according to the profile, into a murderer, and people were out there using the situation to settle scores and fuck over their enemies. Chapter 22. Sunday was no different. He was greeted upon his arrival with a fresh batch of call-in tips. These he went through quickly in his cubicle, first separating out the Spanish-only calls and putting them on Lourdes' desk for her to handle the following day. He then responded to the remaining tips with calls when necessary and the trash can when warranted. By noon he had completed the task and had only one potentially viable lead to show for the effort. The lead came from an anonymous female caller who reported seeing a man wearing a mask running down 7th Street toward McClay shortly after 12 p.m. Friday. She refused to give her name and had called in on a cell phone with a blocked number. She told the operator that she had been driving west on 7th when she saw the man in the mask. He was running east on the opposite side of the street and stopped at one point to try the door handles on three cars parked along 7th. When he was unable to open these cars, he continued running toward McClay. The caller said she lost sight of the man after she passed by him. Vosh was intrigued by the tip, because the timing of the sighting coincided with the attempted assault on Beatrice Sahagun just a few blocks away. What pushed the tip even further toward legitimacy was that the caller described the mask worn by the runner as black with a green and red design. This matched Sahagun's description of the mask worn by her would-be rapist, and these descriptors had not been released publicly through the media. What troubled Vosh about the tip was why the suspect would have kept the mask on while fleeing from Sahagun's house. A man running while wearing a mask would draw far more attention than just a man running. Harry thought that maybe the man was still disoriented after being struck by Sahagun with a broomstick. Another reason could be that he was known to people in that neighborhood and wanted to shield his identity. The caller said nothing about whether the man was wearing gloves, but Vosh assumed that if he kept the mask on, he had also kept his gloves on. Vosh got up from his desk chair and started pacing in the tiny detective bureau as he considered the tip and what it could mean. The scenario, as reported by the anonymous caller, suggested that the screen cutter was trying to find an unlocked car that he could steal in order to make his getaway. This suggested that he did not have a getaway vehicle, or the one he did have, for some unknown reason, became unavailable to him. This idea intrigued Vosh the most. The previous assaults credited to the screen cutter appeared to be carefully planned and choreographed. Escape is always a critical part of any plan. What happened to the getaway car? Was there an accomplice who panicked and took off? Or was there another reason for the escape on foot? The second issue was the mask. The caller said the suspect was running toward McClay, a commercial street lined with small shops and mom-and-pop-style restaurants. At noon on Friday, motorists and pedestrians would be on McClay, and the appearance of a man wearing a Mexican wrestling mask would be noticed by many. And yet this was the only tip so far that mentioned the running man. This told Vosh that the screen cutter pulled the mask off just as he got to the corner and either turned onto McClay or crossed it. Vosh knew the answers to his questions wouldn't be found while pacing in the detective bureau. He went back to his desk and grabbed his keys and sunglasses off the desk. As he exited the bureau, he almost ran into Captain Trevino, who was in the hallway. "Hey, Cap."
"Harry, where are you going?"
"Going to grab lunch." Vosh kept going. It might have been his intention to get lunch while he was out, but he wasn't interested in sharing his real destination with Trevino. If it went from anonymous tip to legitimate lead, he would inform the boss. He picked up speed so he would be to the side of the door of the station before Trevino checked the attendance board in the bureau and saw that Vosh had once again failed to sign in or out. It took him 3 minutes to drive to the corner of McClay and 7th. Botch parked his rented Cherokee and got out. He stood on the corner and looked around. It was an intersection of commercial and residential zones. McClay was lined with small businesses, shops, and restaurants. Seventh was lined with small gated properties that were supposed to be single-family homes, but Botch knew that many of those homes were shared by multiple families, and even more people lived in illegally converted garages. He spotted a trash can near the corner and got an idea. If the screen cutter pulled off his mask and gloves when he got to McClay, would he keep them? Would he carry them in his hands, or stuff them into his pockets? Or would he dump them? It was known that he had had access to, and had used other masks in his crimes. Dumping the wrestling mask and gloves would have been the smart move once he was on the busy commercial street. Botch went to the trash can and lifted the top off. It had been little more than 48 hours since the attempted assault on Beatrice Sahagun. Botch doubted the city had emptied the can in that time, and he was right. It had been a busy weekend on McClay, and the trash can was nearly full. Botch took a pair of latex gloves out of his jacket pocket, and then removed the jacket and hung it over the back of a nearby bus bench. He then put on the gloves, rolled up his sleeves, and went to work. It was a disgusting process, with a can largely filled with rotting food and the occasional disposable baby diaper. It also appeared that at some point during the weekend, someone had vomited directly into the receptacle. It took him a solid 10 minutes to thoroughly dig through it to the bottom. He found no mask and no gloves. Undaunted, Botch went to the next trash can 20 yards further down McClay and started the same process. Without his jacket on, his badge was visible on his belt, and that probably stopped shop owners and passers-by from asking what he was doing. At the second can, he drew the attention of a family eating at the front window of a taqueria 10 feet away. Botch tried to conduct his search while positioning his body as a visual blind to them. It was more of the same detritus in the second can, but he hit pay dirt halfway through the excavation. There in the debris was a black and leather wrestling mask with a green and red design. Botch straightened up out of the can and stripped off his gloves, dropping them to the ground next to the trash can. He then pulled his cell phone and took several photos of the mask in place in the can. After documenting the find, he called the SFPD comm room and told the officer in charge he needed to call in an evidence team from the sheriff's department to collect the mask from the trash receptacle. "You can't bag it and tag it yourself?" the officer asked. "No, I can't bag it and tag it," Botch said. "There's going to be genetic evidence inside and possibly outside the mask. I want to go 4x4 on it so some lawyer down the line doesn't get to tell a jury I did it all wrong and tainted the case, okay?" "Okay, okay, I was just asking. I need to get Captain Trevino to sign off on this, and then I'll call the sheriffs. It might be a while. I'll be here waiting." A while turned out to be 3 hours. Botch waited patiently, spending part of the time talking to Lourdes when she called him after he had texted her a photo of the mask. It was a good find, and would help bring a new dimension to their understandings of the screen cutter. They also agreed there would undoubtedly be genetic material inside the mask that could be linked to the rapist. In that regard, it would be like the semen collected in 3 of the other assaults, a definitive link, but only if the suspect was identified. Botch said he was holding out hope that they would do better and that the treated leather of the mask would hold a fingerprint left when the mask was pulled on and adjusted. A fingerprint would be a whole new angle. The screen cutter may never have been DNA typed, but he could have been fingerprinted. A driver's license in California required a thumbprint. If there was a thumbprint on the mask, they might be in business. Botch had worked cases with the LAPD where prints were pulled off of leather coats and boots. It wasn't a reach to hope the mask could be the casebreaker. "You done good, Harry," Lourdes said. "Now I wish I was working today." "It's okay," Botch said. "We're both on the case now. My get is your get and vice versa." "Well, that attitude will make Captain Trevino happy, which is what we're all striving for." She was laughing as they disconnected. Botch went back to waiting. Repeatedly through the afternoon, he had to shoo away pedestrians aiming to use a trash can for its public purpose. The one instance where someone got by him was when he remembered he had left his sports coat on the bus bench up at the corner and walked back to retrieve it. When he turned back around, he saw a woman who was pushing a baby carriage throw something into the receptacle containing the mask. She had come out of nowhere and Bosch was too late to stop her. He expected to find another disposable diaper when he returned, but instead found a half-eaten ice cream cone splatted directly on the mask. Cursing to himself, Bosch put on latex again, reached in and flipped the melting chocolate mess off the mask. When he did so, he saw a single glove, much like the one he was wearing underneath the mask. It reduced his frustration level, but not by much. The two-man forensic team from the sheriff's department didn't arrive until almost 4 p.m., and they didn't seem too pleased about the Sunday afternoon call-out, or the fact that they would be working in a trash can. Bosch was unapologetic, and asked them to photograph, chart, and collect the evidence. That process, which included emptying the entire contents of the can onto plastic sheets, and then examining each piece before transferring it to a second sheet, took nearly 2 hours. In the end, the mask and two gloves were recovered and taken to the sheriff's lab for analysis, along all lines of evidence. Bosch asked for a rush, but the lead forensic tech just nodded and smiled as though he was dealing with a naive child who thought he was first in line in life. Bosch got back to the detective bureau at 7 and saw no sign of Captain Trevino. The door to his office was closed, and the transom window dark. Bosch sat down in his cubicle and typed up an evidence report on the recovery of the mask and gloves and the anonymous tip that led to them. He then printed 2 copies, one for his file and one for the captain. He went back to the computer and filled out a supplemental lab request form that would be sent to the sheriff's lab at Cal State LA and serve as a means of doubling down on the request for a rush. The timing was good. A courier from the lab made a weekly stop at the SFPD on Mondays to drop off and pick up evidence. Bosch's request for a rush would get to the lab by the next afternoon, even if the forensic tech who collected the evidence didn't pass along his verbal request. In the request, Bosch asked for a complete examination of the mask inside and out for fingerprints, hair, and all other genetic material. Additionally, he asked them to check the inside of the latex gloves for similar evidence. He cited the fact that the investigation was a serial offender case as the reason for fast-tracking the analysis. He wrote, "This offender will not stop his terror and violence against women until we stop him. Please speed this along." This time he printed out 3 copies of his work, one for his own case file, one for Trevino, and the third for the lab courier. After dropping off the 3rd copy at the evidence control room, Bosch was clear to head home. He had put in a solid day and had broken out a good lead with the mask and gloves. But instead he headed back to his cubicle to shift cases and spend some time on the Vance investigation. Thanks to the attendance board, he knew that Trevino had long ago signed out for the day and that he need not worry about being discovered. Bosch was intrigued by the story Hallie Lewis had told him about Dominic Santinello being drawn into the Chicano Pride movement while in training down in San Diego. His description of the park beneath a freeway overpass was particularly worth checking into. Bosch came at it from several angles on Google, and soon enough he was looking at photos and a map of a place called Chicano Park, which was located beneath the 5 freeway and the exit to the bridge crossing San Diego Bay to Coronado Island. The photos of the park showed dozens of murals painted on every concrete pillar and stanchion supporting the overhead freeway and bridge. The murals depicted religious allegories, cultural heritage, and individuals of note in the Chicano Pride movement. One pillar was painted with a mural that marked the founding of the park in April 1970. Bosch realized that Santinello was in Vietnam by then, which meant that his association with the woman Lewis identified as Gabriella began before the park was formally approved by the city and dedicated. The mural he was looking at listed the park's founding artists at the bottom. The list was long, and the paint faded. The names disappeared behind a bed of zinnias that circled the bottom of the pillar like a wreath. Bosch did not see the name Gabriella, but realized that there were names on the pillar he could not make out. He closed the photo and spent the next 20 minutes searching the internet for a better angle on the pillar, or an early shot taken before the flower wreath grew to obscure the names. He found nothing and was frustrated. There was no guarantee that Gabriella would even be listed on the mural, but he knew he would need to stop at the park and check when he went down to San Diego to look for the 1970 birth records of a girl with a father named Dominic Santinello. After a stop for a combined lunch and dinner at Art's Deli in Studio City, Bosch got to Woodrow Wilson Drive late in the evening. He parked as usual around the bend, and then walked back to his house. He pulled a week's worth of deliveries out of the mailbox, including a small box that had been stuffed in as well. He went into the house and dumped the envelopes onto the dining room table to be dealt with later. But he opened the box and found the GPS detector jammer he had ordered. He grabbed a beer out of the fridge and stripped off his jacket before taking the device over to the reclining chair in front of the living room TV. Normally he would have put on a disc, but he wanted to check the news and see if they were still pumping the screen cutter story. He turned on Channel 5 because it was a local independent channel that paid attention to news stories outside of Hollywood. Bosch had seen a news van with a 5 on the side at the police station on Friday when the press conference took place. The news was already underway when he turned the television on. He started reading through the instruction manual that came with the GPS device and kept one ear on the TV. He was halfway through learning how to identify a GPS tracker and jam its signal when the drone of the news anchor caught his attention. Vance was instrumental in the development of stealth technologies. He looked up and saw a photo of a much younger Whitney Vance on the screen, and then it was gone, and the anchor was on to the next story. Bosch leaned forward in his chair, fully alert. He grabbed the remote and switched over to Channel 9, but there was nothing on Vance. Bosch got up and went to the laptop on the dining room table. He went to the homepage of the Los Angeles Times. The top headline read, "Report, billionaire Whitney Vance dies, steel tycoon also left mark on aviation." The story was short because information was short. It simply said that Aviation Week was reporting on its website that Whitney Vance had died after a brief illness. The report cited unnamed sources and gave no details other than to say Vance had died peacefully at his home in Pasadena. Bosch slammed the laptop closed. "God damn it," he said. The report in the Times didn't even confirm the report in Aviation Week. Bosch got up and paced the living room, not sure what he could do, but feeling guilty in some way and not trusting the report that Vance died peacefully in his home. As he came back toward the dining room table, he saw the business card Vance had given him. He pulled his phone and called the number. This time it was answered. "Hello?" Bosch knew the voice did not belong to Whitney Vance. He didn't say anything. "Is this Mr. Bosch?" Bosch hesitated, but then answered. "Who is this?" "It's Sloan." "Is he really dead?" "Yes, Mr. Vance has passed on. And that means your services are no longer needed. Goodbye, Mr. Bosch." "Did you kill him, you bastards?" Sloan hung up halfway through the question. Bosch almost hit the redial button, but knew that Sloan would not take the call. The number would soon be dead, and so, too, would Bosch's connection to the Vance Empire. "God damn it," he said again. His words echoed through the empty house. Chapter 23 Bosch stayed up half the night jumping from CNN to Fox News, and then online to the Times website, hoping for an update on the death of Whitney Vance. But he came away disappointed in the supposed 24 hours news cycle. There were no updates on the cause of, or details about the death. All each entry did was add backstory, digging out old clips and adding them to the tale of the very thinly reported breaking news of the death. At about 2 a.m., CNN reran the 1996 interview Larry King did with Vance on his book publication. Bosch watched this with interest because it showed a much more spry and engaging version of Vance. Sometime after that, Bosch fell asleep in the leather chair in front of the television, 4 empty bottles on the table next to him. The TV was still on when he awoke, and the first image he saw was the coroner's van exiting through the gate of the Vance estate on San Rafael and driving past the camera. The camera then held on the black steel gate rolling closed. In the video, it was dark on the street, but there was no time stamp. Because Vance would get the VIP treatment from the coroner's office, Bosch guessed that the body was not removed until the middle of the night after a thorough investigation that would have included detectives from the Pasadena Police Department. It was 7 a.m. in Los Angeles, and that meant the Eastern media was already well into the Vance story. The CNN anchor flipped the story to a financial reporter who talked about Vance's majority holdings in the company his father had founded and what could happen now that he had died. The reporter said that Vance had no known heirs, and so it remained to be seen what instructions he left in his will for the distribution of his wealth and holdings. The reporter intimated that there could be surprises in the will. He added that Vance's probate attorney, a Century City lawyer named Cecil Dobbs, could not be reached for comment because of the early hour in Los Angeles. Bosch knew he had to get up to San Fernando to continue working through the latest call-in tips and leads on the screen cutter case. He slowly climbed out of the leather chair, felt his back protest in a half dozen places, and made his way to his bedroom to shower and prepare for the day. The shower made him feel crisp, at least temporarily. As he dressed, he realized he was famished. In the kitchen, he brewed a half pot of coffee and then began searching for something to eat. Without his daughter living in the house anymore, Bosch had fallen off on keeping the cabinets and refrigerator stocked. All he found was a box of Eggo waffles in the freezer containing two Last Soldiers exhibiting freezer burn. Bosch put them both in the toaster and hoped for the best. He checked the cabinets and refrigerator a second time and found no syrup, butter, or even peanut butter anywhere. He was going to have to go dry with the waffles. He took the coffee in a mug left over from his LAPD homicide days. Printed around its circumference was "Our day begins when your day ends." And he learned that eating waffles without syrup or other additives made them portable. He sat down at the dining room table and ate them by hand while sorting through the mail that had accumulated on the table. It was an easy process because 4 out of every 5 pieces were junk mail that he could easily identify without opening them. He put these in a pile to the left, and the mail he would have to open and deal with to the right. This included pieces of correspondence addressed to his neighbors, but mistakenly stuffed into his box. He was halfway through the pile when he came to an 8x5 padded manila envelope with a heavy object in it. There was no return address, and his own address was scrawled in an unsteady hand. The envelope had a South Pasadena postmark. He opened it and slid out the object. A gold pen he immediately recognized. It now had a cap, but he knew it was Whitney Vance's. There were also 2 separately folded pieces of stationery of a high-grade pale yellow stock. Bosch unfolded the first one and found himself looking at a handwritten letter to him from Whitney Vance. The stationery had Vance's name and the San Rafael Avenue address printed across the bottom. The letter had the previous Wednesday's date on it, the day after Bosch had gone to Pasadena to meet Vance.
"Detective Bosch, if you're reading this, then my most loyal and trusted Ida has been successful in getting this envelope to you. I am placing my trust in you, as I have done with her for many decades. It was a pleasure to meet you yesterday, and I can sense that you are an honorable man who will do what is right in any circumstance. I am counting on your integrity. No matter what happens to me, I want you to continue your search. If there is an heir to what I have on this earth, then I want that person to have what is mine. I want you to find that person, and I trust that you will. It gives an old man a sense of redemption to know he has done the right thing at last. Be safe. Be vigilant and determined. Whitney P. Vance, October 5th, 2016.
Bosch reread the letter before unfolding the second document. It was handwritten in the same shaky but legible scrawl as the first. Whitney Vance, Last Will and Testament, October 5th, 2016. I, Whitney Vance of Pasadena, Los Angeles County, California, write this will by hand to declare my desires for the disposition of my estate after my death. As of the date of this will, I am of sound mind and am entirely capable of determining my own affairs. I am not married. By this will, I expressly revoke any and all previous antecedent wills and codicils, declaring any and all to be null, void, and invalid. I have currently employed the investigative services of Hieronymus Bosch to ascertain
and locate my issue and the heir of my body conceived in spring 1950 by Viviana Duarte and born of her in due course. I charged Mr. Bosch to bring forward the heir of my body with reasonably sufficient genealogical and scientific proof of heredity and genetic descent, so that the heir of my body may receive my estate. I appoint Hieronymus Bosch sole executor of this, my will. No bond or other security shall be required of Mr. Bosch as executor of my will. He shall pay my just debts and obligations, which shall include a reasonably generous fee for his service. To Ida Town Forsyth, my secretary, friend and confidant of 35 years, I give, devise, and bequeath $10 million, together with my thanks and gratitude for her loyal service, counsel, and friendship. To the heir of my body, my issue, my genetic descendant, and the last of my bloodline, I give, devise, and bequeath all of the remainder of my estate in its entirety, of any, all, and whatever kind and character, which shall include all my bank accounts, all my stocks, bonds, and business interests, my homes, and all my real property in fee simple, and all my personal property, possessions, and chattels. In particular, to the heir of my body, I bequeath the pen with which this will is written. It is made of gold mined by our progenitors and passed down through generations to have and hold until it is passed to succeeding generations of our blood. Done by, and in my own hand, Whitney P. Vance, October 5, 2016, at 11:30 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Bosch was stunned by what he had in his hands. He reread the will, and it didn't lessen his wonder. He held a document that was essentially worth billions of dollars, a document that could change the course of a giant corporation and industry, not to mention the life and family of an unsuspecting woman born 46 years ago of a father she never knew. That is, if she was still alive and Bosch could find her. Bosch read the first letter for the third time and took Whitney Vance's charge to heart. He would be vigilant and determined. He refolded the two documents and returned them to the envelope. He hefted the heavy pen in his hand for a moment and then placed it back in the envelope as well. He realized that at some point there would be an authentication process, and he might have already damaged it by his handling of the stationery. He took the envelope into the kitchen and found a large resealable plastic bag to preserve it in. Bosch also knew he had to safeguard the package. He suspected that there would be many forces out there bent on destroying it. The thought reminded him of when Howard Hughes died and various wills came to the surface. He didn't remember how that probate was decided, but he recalled the multiple claims to the fortune. The same could be the case with Vance. Bosch knew he needed to make copies of the documents in the envelope and then secure the originals in his safe deposit box. Bosch went back into the living room and turned off the TV so he could make a call. He hit the speed dial for Mickey Haller's cell phone, and his half-brother picked up the call after one ring. "What's up, Rohan?" "Are you my lawyer?" "What? Of course I am. What'd you do now?" "Funny. You're not going to believe this. Are you sitting down?" "I'm sitting in the back of the Lincoln heading in to see my girl Clara Foltz." The translation was that Haller was heading to court. The downtown courthouse was formerly known as the Clara Shortridge Foltz Criminal Justice Center. "You heard about Whitney Vance dying?" Bosch asked. "I heard something about it on the radio, yeah," Haller said. "But what do I care about some billionaire kicking the bucket?" "Well, I'm holding his last will and testament. He sent it to me. It names me executor, and I don't know the first thing about what to do with it." "Are you pulling my dick, Brohame?" "No, Brohame, I'm not pulling your dick." "Where are you?" "Home. Hold on." Bosch then heard Haller redirect his driver from the downtown destination to the Cahuenga Pass where Bosch lived. Then he got back on the line. "How the fuck did you end up with his will?" Bosch gave him a short summary of the Vance case. He also revealed that this was the case he had called Haller about to get the referral to a private DNA lab.
Okay, who else knows you have this will? Haller asked. No one, Bosch said. Actually, somebody might. It came in the mail, and Vance's letter says he gave the task to his longtime secretary. But I don't know if she knew what was in the package she mailed. She's in the will to the tune of $10 million. That's a big reason to make sure she got the will to you. You said it came in the mail? Was it certified? Did you have to sign for it? No, it was stuffed into the box with all the junk mail. That was risky, but maybe it was the best way to get it to you under the radar. Slip it out with the secretary, have her drop it in the mailbox. Okay, listen. I need to get off the line so I can get somebody to take my appearance in arraignment court. But you sit tight. I'm heading your way. Do you still have that copier in the car? Sure do. Good. We need to make copies. Definitely. Do you even know anything about wills and probate, Mick? Hey, bro, you know me. Have case will travel. Doesn't matter what kind of case it is, I can handle it. And what I don't know, I can bring somebody in on to help. I'll be there inside of 30. As Bosch put the phone down, he wondered if he had made a critical mistake bringing the Lincoln lawyer into the case. His instincts were that Haller's lack of experience in probate and inheritance law would be more than balanced by his street smarts and legal cunning. Bosch had seen him work, and knew he had something that didn't come with training, no matter what the school or specialty. He had a deep hollow that he somehow filled by standing as a David against the Goliaths of the world, whether in the form of the power and might of the state or a billion-dollar corporation. Bosch also had no doubts about Haller guarding his back. He could trust him. And he had a growing feeling that this might be the most important support to have in the days ahead. He checked his watch and saw it was near 9 now, and Bella Lourdes would be at the station. He called, but she didn't answer. He assumed that was because she was already working the phones responding to the batch of call-in tips he had left on her desk. He was leaving her a message telling her to call him back when his call waiting indicated she was already doing so. Good morning, he said. Good morning, she said. Where are you? I'm still at home. You're going to have to handle things on your own today. She groaned and asked why. Something's come up on a private case I'm working, he said. It can't wait. The one with all the birth certificates, she asked. How did you... He remembered her eyeing the stack of copies he had placed on his desk in the cubicle. Never mind, he said. Just don't mention that to anybody. I should be back in a couple of days. A couple days? Lourdes exclaimed. Harry, the proverbial iron is hot right now. This guy just tried to strike for the first time we know about in 8 months. We now have the mask. Things are happening, and we really need you in here. I know, but this other thing can't wait, and it looks like I have to go to San Diego. You're killing me, Harry. What's the case? I can't tell you right now. When I can, I will. That's nice of you. And it's more important than a guy running around up here raping Mexican girls. It's not more important. But we both know that the screen cutter is lying low right now with all this attention. Unless he's already split, and if he has, then we're spinning our wheels anyway. Okay, fine. I'll let the cap know, and I'm sure he'll be happy not to have you around. Last thing he wants is for you to crack this thing anyway. There you go. No, there you go, running out on the case. Look, I'm not running out. The other thing will clear soon. I'm only a phone call away. In fact, there's something I was going to do today, but you need to do it now instead. And what's that? The caller who led me to the mask said the guy was checking car doors while he was running. So? So something happened that messed up his getaway. Yeah, Beatrice clocked him with a broomstick. Something more. He lost his ride. You mean you think he had a getaway driver? Maybe we're looking for more than one suspect. Different masks, different rapists, but working together, is that it? No, the DNA is from one offender. Right, forgot. So you think he's a rapist with a getaway driver? I thought about that, but it's a long shot. Most serial offenders are loners. There are exceptions, but it's rare. Most of the time you go with the percentages, then you come out ahead. Okay, then what? I think you should go out and search Beatrice's house again. Do you guys have a metal detector? A metal detector? For what? The backyard by the window the screen cutter jumped through. I think maybe he lost his keys to his getaway car when he went through the window and hit the ground. There's a bed of vines and ground cover there. Right, I saw. It was a panic move. He's disoriented by the blow from the broomstick. He drops the knife, jumps through the window, and falls on the ground. His keys could have gone flying. So what's he do? Can't sit there looking through the bushes and vines. He's got to get out of there. He just starts running. That, to me, sounds like the long shot. Maybe. But this guy is a planner, and there he was, running down the street trying to find an unlocked car to boost.
True.
Anyway, what else are you going to do? Chase call-in tips and lookalikes all day? There you go again against the tip line. But you do have a point. And they do have a metal detector over at Public Works for finding underground pipes and cables and stuff. We used it once to find a gun a banger wrapped in plastic and buried in his backyard. Tied him to an assault with a deadly. If Dockweiler's over there, he'll let us use it. If he's in a good mood. Grab that and run it through the bushes and ground cover under that window. You don't grab it, it's like a lawnmower, it's got wheels. Then take Sisto with you. Give him a chance to redeem himself.
Redeem himself for what?
I don't really think his heart was in it the other day. He was babysitting the scene for us, playing on his phone the whole time, not paying attention. Not his case, not invested. Between you and me, his search was lazy. We're lucky he found the knife without cutting himself on it. But we're not judgmental, are we? Back in the day, we'd say a guy like that couldn't find shit in his mustache with a comb.
We are just brutal.
I know what I saw. I'm glad I'm working with you and not him. She paused, and Bosch knew it was to smile. I think there's a compliment in there somewhere, she said then. From the great Harry Bosch, no less. Anyway, sounds like a plan. I'll let you know. Remember, you find something, you owe me a beer. You also should ask Sisto about thefts Friday from Area 2, the other side of McClay. Maybe the screen cutter grabbed a car over there.
Aren't you just full of ideas today?
Yeah, that's why I get the big bucks. And all because of one of the tip line calls that you swore up and down were going to be a complete waste of time. When you're wrong, you're wrong. And I admit, I was wrong. You heard it here first, folks. I gotta go, Bella. Be careful out there. You too, with whatever your super secret case is. Roger that. They disconnected. Chapter 24. While Haller studied the letter and will that Bosch had unpackaged and spread with gloved hands on the dining room table, Harry worked his computer, seeing if he could get access to the 1970 birth records in San Diego County. Whitney Vance's death was a game changer. He felt a more urgent need to nail down the heir question. He needed to get this to the DNA level. He needed to find Dominic Santinello's daughter. Unfortunately, he found that the Bureau of Vital Records and Statistics had digital records going back only 24 years. As he had in his search for Santinello's birth certificate, Bosch would need to look through physical records and microfilm by hand to find a San Diego County birth in 1970. He was writing down the address for the Bureau on Rosecrans Street when Haller completed his first assessment of the two documents. "This is off the charts," he said. Bosch looked at him. "What is?" he asked. "Every damn thing about this," Haller said. "What you have here is a holographic will, okay? That means it was handwritten, and I checked on the way over. Holographic wills are accepted as legal instruments upon verification in California." Vance probably knew that. Oh, he knew a lot. That's why he sent you the pen. Not for the bullshit reason in the will. He sent it because he knew verification is key. You say that when you met with him last week at the mansion, he was of sound mind and body, like he says here?
That's right.
And exhibiting no signs of illness or health threat. Other than being old and fragile, none. I wonder then what the coroner will find. I wonder if the coroner will even look. An 85-year-old man comes through, they're not going to look too long and hard at him. 85-year-olds die, it's no mystery.
You mean there won't be an autopsy?
There should be, but that doesn't mean there will be. If the Pasadena police signed off on it at the scene as a natural, there might not be a full autopsy unless there's visible evidence to the contrary upon medical examiner's inspection. I guess we'll see. You have a connection inside Pasadena PD?
Nope.
You?
Nope.
Upon his arrival, Haller's driver had carried in the photocopier printer from the Lincoln, then returned to wait behind the wheel. Haller now pulled gloves from the cardboard dispenser Bosch had placed on the table. He stretched a pair on and started making copies of the documents. "Why don't you have a copier here?" he asked while he worked. "I did," Bosch said. "Had a printer-copier combo, but Maddie took it to school with her. Haven't gotten around to getting another." "How's she doing down there?"
"Good. How about Haley?"
"She's good, too. Totally into it."
"That's good."
An awkward silence followed. Both their daughters, the same age and each other's only cousin, had gone to Chapman University. But because of different majors and interests, they had not formed the tight bond their fathers had hoped for and expected. They had shared a dorm room in the first year, but gone separate ways the second. Haley had stayed in the dorms, and Maddie had rented the house with girls from the psychology department. After making at least a dozen copies of the will, Haller moved on to the letter Vance wrote to Bosch, and started making an equal number of copies.
"Why so many?" Bosch asked.
"'Cause you never know," Haller said. That was a non-answer, Bosch thought.
"So what do we do from here?" he asked.
"Nothing," Haller said.
"What?"
"Nothing for now. Nothing public, nothing in the courts. We just lie low and wait."
"Why?"
"You keep working the case. Confirm that Vance has an heir. Once we have that, we see who makes a move. See what the corporation does. When they make their move, we make ours. But we make our move from a position of knowing what they're up to.
We don't even know who they are."
"Sure we do. It's all of them. It's the corporation, the board of directors, the security people. It's all of them."
"Well, they may be watching us right now."
"We have to assume they are. But they don't know what we have here. Otherwise, this package wouldn't have sat in your mailbox for 4 days.
Bosch nodded. It was a good point.
Haller gestured to the documents on the table, meaning the two originals. "We have to safeguard these," he said. "At all costs."
"I have a safe deposit box," Bosch said.
"Studio City."
"You can bet they already know that. They probably know everything about you.
So we make copies, and you put copies in your bank box. If they're watching you, they'll think that's where the will is."
"And where will it really be?"
"You'll figure something out. But don't tell me."
"Why not?"
"In case I get hit with an order from a judge to produce the will. If I don't have it and don't know where it is, I can't produce it."
"Smart."
"We need to get to Ida Forsyth, too. If you're right about her being the one who smuggled this stuff to the post office, then we need to lock her story down in a statement. It will be part of the chain of authenticity. We'll need verification of every step we take. When I finally go into court with this, I don't want my ass hanging out in the wind."
"I can get her address, if she has a driver's license."
Still wearing gloves, Haller picked up the gold pen. "And this," he said.
"You're sure it's the one he had last week?"
"Pretty sure. I saw it in photos, too, on a wall in the mansion. A photo of him signing a book to Larry King."
"Cool.
Maybe we'll bring Larry into court to verify. That'll get a headline or two. We'll also need Ida to confirm it as well. Remember, verification on all levels. His pen, his signature and the pen's ink, we'll match it. I have a lab that will do that, when the time is right."
Finished with the copying, Haller started collating the documents, creating a dozen sets of both.
"You have paper clips?" he asked.
"No," Bosch said.
"I have some in the car. You take half of these and I'll take half. Put a set under the mattress in the safe deposit box. Doesn't hurt to have them in many places. I'll do the same."
"Where do you go from here?"
"I go to court and act like I don't know shit about any of this while you find and confirm that heir."
"When I get to her, do I tell her or confirm on the sly?"
"That's got to be your call when you reach that point. But whatever you decide, remember that secrecy is our edge, for now."
"Got it."
Haller went to the front door and whistled to get his driver's attention. He signaled him to come in to get the printer copier. He then stepped out onto the front stoop and looked both ways up the street before coming back in. The driver entered, unplugged the machine, and wrapped the cord around it so he could carry it back without tripping on it. Haller walked over to the sliding glass doors in the living room to look out at the view of Cahuenga Pass. "Your view is quieter," he said. "Lots of trees." Haller lived on the other side of the hill with an unfettered view across the Sunset Strip and the vast expanse of the city. Bosch stepped over and slid the door open a few feet so Haller could hear the never-ending hiss of the freeway at the bottom of the pass. "Not so quiet," Bosch said. "Sounds like the ocean," Haller said. "A lot of people up here tell themselves that. Sounds like a freeway to me." "You know, you've seen a lot with all the murders you worked for all those years. All the human depravity, the cruelty." Haller kept his eyes focused out into the pass. There was a red-tailed hawk floating on spread wings above the ridgeline on the other side of the freeway. "But you haven't seen anything like this," he continued. "There are billions of dollars on the line here, and people will do anything, I mean anything, to maintain control of it. Be ready for that." "You too," Bosch said. Chapter 25 20 minutes later, Bosch left the house. When he got to the rented Cherokee, he used the GPS detector for the first time, walking completely around the SUV, holding the device down low with its antenna pointed toward the undercarriage and wheel wells. He got no response. He popped the front hood and went through a similar process as instructed in the manual. Again, nothing. He then switched the device to its jamming frequency as a precaution and got behind the wheel. He took Wrightwood down to Ventura and Studio City, and then jogged west to his bank, which was located in a shopping plaza off of Laurel Canyon Boulevard. He had not been to the safe deposit box in at least 2 years. It contained primarily his own documents, birth and marriage and divorce certificates, and military service documentation. He kept his two purple hearts in a box in there, along with a commendation he had received from the chief of police for pulling a pregnant woman out of a fiery wreck when he was a boot. He put one copy of the Vance documents in the box, and then returned it to the handler from the bank. Bosch checked his surroundings when he got back to the rental car, and initially saw no signs of surveillance. But when he pulled out of the bank's parking lot onto Laurel Canyon, he saw in his rear view a car with dark-tinted windows pull out of the same lot, but at a different exit point, and fall in behind him 100 yards back. Bosch knew it was a busy shopping plaza, so he didn't immediately jump to the conclusion that he was being followed. But he decided to avoid the freeway and stay on Laurel Canyon so he could keep a better eye on the traffic behind him. Continuing north, he checked the mirror every block or so. By its distinctive grille work, he identified the dark green car trailing him as a BMW sedan. After 2 miles, he was still on Laurel Canyon, and the BMW was still in traffic behind him. Even though Bosch had slowed at times, and sped up at others, and the Beamer had occasionally changed lanes on the four-lane boulevard, it had never changed the distance between them. Bosch became increasingly convinced he was being tailed. He decided to try to confirm it by doing a basic square knot maneuver. He took the next right, pinned the accelerator, and drove down to the stop sign at the end of the block. He took another right, and then turned right again at the next stop sign. He then drove at the speed limit back to Laurel Canyon Boulevard. He checked the mirrors. The Beamer had not followed him through the maneuver. He turned back onto Laurel Canyon and continued north. He saw no sign of the Beamer. It was either well north of him, because the driver was not tailing him, or it was gone because Bosch's maneuver had revealed to the driver that he had spotted the tail. 10 minutes later, Bosch pulled into the employee lot at the San Fernando police station. He entered through the side door and found the detective bureau empty. He wondered if Sisto had gone with Lourdes to research the Sahagun house. Maybe Bella had told Sisto about Bosch's poor review of Friday's search, and Sisto had insisted on going as a result. At his desk, Bosch picked up the phone and called Lourdes to inquire about the search, but the call rang through to voicemail, and he left word for her to call back when she was free. With no sign of Trevino around, he next ran a DMV search on Ida Town's Forsyth and picked up an address on Arroyo Drive in South Pasadena. He thought of the envelope from Vance having a South Pasadena postmark as he jumped over to Google Maps and plugged in the address. He pulled up a visual and saw that Forsythe had a very nice home on a street overlooking the Arroyo Seco Wash. It appeared that Vance had taken good care of his most trusted and long-term employee. His last move in the detective bureau was to pull out the file on one of the unsolved murders he was working and fill out an evidence recovery form. He listed the evidence as victim's property, then put the two original Vance documents and the gold pen contained in the original mailing envelope into a plastic evidence bag. He sealed the bag and put it into a cardboard evidence storage box. He sealed this as well with red breakaway tape, which would show any sign of tampering. Bosch walked the box back to the evidence control room and checked it into the locker where other evidence accumulated during the investigation was already being stored. Bosch believed the original of the Vance will was now properly hidden and secured. The evidence control officer printed a receipt for him, and he took it back to the bureau to put in the case file. He was just locking his file drawer when his phone buzzed with a call on the intercom. It was the front desk officer. "Detective Bosch, you have a visitor up front." Bosch guessed that it was somebody coming in with what they believed was a tip on the screen cutter. He knew that he couldn't get bogged down with that case today. He hit the intercom button. "Is it a tip about the screen cutter? Can you ask whoever it is to come back this afternoon and ask for Detective Lourdes?" There was no immediate response, and Bosch assumed the desk officer was asking the visitor to state his or her business. He knew that if it was another screen cutter victim, he would need to drop everything and handle it. He could not let a potential sixth victim walk out of the police station without being interviewed. He went to his screen, clicked back to the DMV page on Ida Forsythe, and printed it out so he would have her address handy when he went to her home to talk to her. He was about to go retrieve it from the communal printer when the desk man's voice came back over the intercom. "He's asked for you specifically, Detective Bosch. He says it's about the Vance case." Bosch stared at his desk phone for a long moment before responding. "Tell him I'm coming out. 1 minute." Bosch signed off his computer and left the bureau, but he went out the side door rather than taking the main hallway to the front lobby of the station. He then walked around the outside of the station to the front, where he stood at the corner of the building and checked the street to try to determine if his visitor had come alone. He noticed no one who looked suspicious, but he did see a dark green BMW with near black tinted windows parked at the curb in front of the Department of Public Works across from the police station. The car was as long as Haller's town car, and Bosch could see a driver waiting behind the wheel. He quickly doubled back to the side entrance of the station and went back through to the front lobby. He was expecting the visitor to be Sloan, but when he got there he realized he had shot low. It was Creighton, the man who had sent him down the path to Vance in the first place. "Having trouble following me?" Bosch said by way of a greeting. "You come in to get my itinerary?" Creighton nodded his confirmation that he had been tailing Bosch. "Yes, I should have known better," he said. "You probably had us since the bank." "What do you want, Creighton?" Creighton frowned. Bosch's dispensing with first names and titles signaled that the old LAPD bonds were of no use to him here. "I want you to stand down," Creighton said. "I don't know what you're talking about," Bosch said. "Stand down from what?" "Your employer has died. Your employment is now terminated. Speaking for the corporation, which is all there is now." "Stop what you're doing." "What makes you think I'm doing anything?" "We know what you're doing, and we know why. We even know what your low-rent attorney is doing. We've been watching you." Bosch had thoroughly scoured the street before leaving his house. He now knew that rather than looking for people in cars, he should have looked for cameras. He now wondered if they had been inside his home as well. And making the jump to Haller, Bosch assumed that the lawyer had made a call about the case that had put him on their radar as well. He looked at Creighton without showing any indication of being intimidated. "Well, I'll take all this under advisement," he said. "You know your way out." He stepped away from Creighton, but then the former deputy chief spoke again. "I don't think you really understand the position you're in." Bosch turned and came back at him. He got up in his face. "What position is that?" "You're on very dangerous ground. You need to make careful decisions. I represent people who reward those who make careful decisions." I don't know if that is a threat or a bribe, or maybe both. Take it any way you want. Okay, then. I will take it as a threat and a bribe, and you are under arrest. Bosch grabbed him by the elbow, and in one swift move directed him face first to the tiled wall of the lobby. With one hand pressing against Creighton's back, he snaked his other hand under his jacket and behind his own back to his handcuffs. Creighton tried to turn his head to face him.
What the hell are you doing? Creighton barked.
You are under arrest for threatening a police officer and attempted bribery, Bosch said. Spread your legs and keep your face against the wall. Creighton seemed too stunned to react. Bosch kicked one of his heels and the man's foot slipped across the tile. Bosch finished handcuffing him and then did a hand search, coming up with a holstered pistol on Creighton's right hip. You're making a big mistake, Creighton said. Maybe, Bosch said. But it feels right because you're such a pompous ass, Creighton. I'll be out in 15 minutes. You know they always called you that, right, Creighton? Let's go. Bosch nodded to the desk officer behind the plexiglass window, and he buzzed the door open. Bosch walked Creighton back to the holding section of the station, where he turned him over to the jail officer. Bosch filled out an arrest report and booked the gun into a property locker, then took the jail officer aside and told him to take his time getting around to letting Creighton make his lawyer call. The last he saw of Creighton was him being locked behind a solid steel door in a single-bed cell. He knew that he wouldn't be in there for long, but it would give Bosch enough time to head south without being followed. Bosch decided to leave the interview with Ida Towns Forsythe for another day. He jumped on the 5 freeway, which would take him all the way to San Diego with a possible stop in Orange. He checked his watch and did some math, then called his daughter. As usual, the call went straight to message. He told her he would be passing through her area between 12:30 and 1 p.m., and made the offer to take her to lunch, or to grab a cup of coffee if she had the time and was up for it. He told her he had something to talk to her about. A half hour later, he was just moving past downtown L.A., when he got the call back from Maddie. Are you coming down the 5? She asked. Hello to you too, he said. Yes, I'm on the 5. It's moving pretty good, so I think I'll be down your way closer to 12:15. Well, I can do lunch. What did you want to tell me? Well, let's talk at lunch. You want to meet, or should I come in and pick you up? It would be about a 15-minute ride from the freeway to campus. I've got such a good parking spot. Any chance you can come get me? Yeah, I just offered to. What do you feel like eating? There's a place I wanted to try over on Balsa. Bosch knew that Balsa was in the heart of an area known as Little Saigon and far from campus. He said, that's kind of far out from the school. To come in to get you, then go out there, and then back in to drop you is probably going to take too much time. I need to get down to, okay, I'll drive, I'll meet you there. Can we just go someplace near the school, Mads? If it's Vietnamese, you know that I don't... Dad, it's been like 50 years. Why can't you just eat the food? It's really being racist. Bosch was quiet for a long moment while he composed an answer. He tried to speak calmly as he delivered it, but things were boiling up inside him. Not just what his daughter had said, but Creighton, the screen cutter, all of it. Maddie... Racism has nothing to do with it, and you should be very careful about throwing an accusation like that around, he said. When I was your age, I was in Vietnam, fighting to protect the people over there, and I had volunteered to be there. Was that racist? It wasn't that simple, Dad. You were supposedly fighting communism. Anyway, it just seems weird that you put up this big stand against the food. Bosch was silent. There were things about himself and his life that he never wanted to share with her. The whole 4 years of his military service was one of them. She knew he had served, but he had never spoken to her about the details of his time in Southeast Asia. Look, for 2 years when I was over there, I ate that food, he said, every day, every meal. Why? Didn't they have regular American food on the base or something? Yes, but I couldn't eat it. If I did, they would smell me in the tunnels. I had to smell like them. Now it was her turn to be silent. What does that mean? She finally said. You smell like what you eat. In enclosed spaces, it comes out of your pores. My job, I had to go into tunnels, and I didn't want the enemy to know I was there. So I ate their food every day, every meal, and I can't do it anymore. It brings it all back to me, okay? There was only silence from her. Bosch held the top of the wheel and drummed his fingers against the dashboard beyond it. He immediately regretted